Hi, you're listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.
Thank you, Lydia. And welcome, and thanks for walking through the hot weather to come and join us up here. We have a very wonderful group of people to share this conversation. The three panellists here, three special guests on the floor here, and we're going to be addressing the subject of interfaith. And I would think this is the main interfaith sort of moment at Greenbelt this year. So we're very pleased to be sharing it with you. This event came about because of it's not a competition. It was a search we launched about 18 months ago, which was called 21 for 21. And we were looking for 21 young faith leaders for the 21st century. It was actually the idea of Justin Cohen, who is editor of the Jewish News. And he's not with us today, sadly. He couldn't make it. But he then contacted Bilal Hassan, who is actually on the panel here. And they thought it would be a good idea to search together, Jewish and Muslim. And Bilal suggested, actually, you know, we need the third leg of the stool here and have Christians involved too. So I was approached as part of my role with Coexist House, who are behind this event today. And they wanted a Christian media partner, because Bilal's from British Muslim Television and Justin from the Jewish News, which is an online Jewish publication. So we wanted a Christian organization.
It's in print too.
It's in print too. Oh, yeah. And so I initially suggested Premier Radio, because I'm a trustee at Premier Radio, but the negotiations went on and it wasn't quite their bag. So I went to Paul Hanley at the Church Times, and he immediately leapt on this as a great idea. So we then launched this nationwide search for 21 young faith leaders. And we did it by asking people to nominate from their various communities. And we had over 100 nominations. And we whittled that down with a very distinguished panel of judges, I recall. And we found our sort of 21 with a slightly longer list as well, who we wanted to honour. And after a while, we were going to do this at number 10, but then the whole sort of Brexit thing got terribly in the way. Sorry, there we go. I've mentioned the word. And we couldn't do it at number 10. Then we were going to go to number 11 Downing Street, but that fell through too. But we had our eventual ceremony at Lambeth Palace. And it was a glorious evening, and we were able to honour our 21 laureates of distinguished for their distinguished interfaith service. And they were all under the age of 40, which we considered was enough to call them young. As a result of that, we want to do other events where we bring them together to share their wisdom and their insights into the world of interfaith. Now, before we go any further, I must just say Bilal is not an imposter on the stage here. He wasn't actually one of the laureates, but Arzu Ahmed texted me late last night and said she had a very bad neck problem and was just unable to travel today, sadly. And Arzu would have been the other member of our panel, and Bilal was going to chair. But because we needed a Muslim to fill the Muslim space on the panel, Bilal graciously agreed to be a panelist. So he's pretending to be one of the laureates of the programme, and it leaves me to chair the occasion. So, Bilal, did you want to share any more about the setting up of it from your perspective at British Muslim Television?
Yeah, I mean, as British Muslim TV, we've always been interested in interfaith work. And what's interesting, and perhaps we can get into this with the discussion, is that I was initially approached by Jewish News to do a Muslim-Jewish young people sort of leader list. And the reality is that often Muslim-Jewish conversation can be very saturating, very difficult and challenging. And so I felt if we brought the Christian voice in, it would almost dilute the potential for there to be problems. We still faced a bit of a backlash from our community as to why we were working with this Jewish outlet, which has in the past potentially stoked the flames of Islamophobia and so on and so forth. But we felt that you know, engaging in the world of interfaith requires you to step out of your comfort zone and to sometimes go against the grain in order to facilitate something greater. And I'm glad we did. And yeah, I'm glad we have an incredible list of 21 young leaders, two of which we're going to be joined by and we'll be hearing from.
And three on the
as
board.
Well as the other three here. So, yeah.
So first of all, the way this is going to run is I'm going to get the three on the stage to talk a little bit about their particular project, which won them the award as well. And Bilal's going to adapt British Muslim Television into that. And then we're going to share a little bit about the joys and the challenges of interfaith. And I think we're all quite seasoned in the interfaith role here. And I think we all know it's much more than what we used to cynically call tea and samosas. And it isn't just about being nice to each other and agreeing with each other and thinking that all faiths are much the same. You know, why don't we all just hold hands and dance around? But actually, you know, it's much more challenging than that. And we really see that. And hopefully you'll see some of the grit that goes into the interfaith work we do. We recognize that this is a very difficult area. So first of all, they're going to talk about their projects, and then we're going to talk about the joys and challenges. Then we'll bring in our special guests on the floor here, who some are Greenbelters anyway and have joined us today because they were laureates as well. And they will chip into the conversation. Then we'll open up to all of you. So do please have your thoughts prepared for questions towards the end. So maybe, Georgia, would you like to kick off with why you're a laureate and the particular project that you're representing today?
Excellent. Hello, everyone. So I work for the Rose Castle Foundation. I'm programme director there. And Rose Castle is a beautiful castle based up in Cumbria. So in the northwest. And we run residential programmes that basically bring people from two sides of a divide together. They live together. We take them on a journey of encountering one another, learning how to engage positively with difference, seeking how to restore genuinely relationships that are the hardest ones to restore, and then to reimagine what life lived well together could look like. So it's a journey of reconciliation that we take people on, and that's very much why I spend my time doing.
You had 3 minutes.
I have 3 minutes to talk more. Excellent. I think a key focus, so to chat more personally about my route into interfaith and why I think at Rose Castle we take a slightly niche angle, is that having come from a conservative community myself, my first reaction to interfaith was a very negative one, and one where interfaith was something I just absolutely couldn't partake in. I struggled to understand it, struggled to understand theologically how I could have integrity with my own faith and be part of the interfaith space. And so having taken that journey myself and realized the gift that interfaith work can be, at Rose Castle, really what we're seeking to do is question who's not in the interfaith space and how can we come alongside them and try and help them take a route that makes sense into that space and really understand what their identity as a reconciler, as a peacemaker, which is completely in line with their own faith and their own tradition. And how can that really be the calling force to engage with those of other faiths? So that's our focus in particular on programs, which actually often means we start by having to focus within faith groups and a lot of the division that is there before bringing people into the interfaith space.
Okay, thanks very much. And Rabbi Debbie, would you like to chip in now?
Sure. So I think there were two parts of the work for the award. One was a project that began when I was a pulpit rabbi at West London Synagogue, which is in central London. I was actually brought in with the remit of directing their interfaith programming, because interfaith had been such a big part of my pre-rabbinic life. What we tried to create was a program for teenagers post what we would call post bar and bat mitzvah, so sort of 13 up, that would work alongside a local Muslim community where our young people learn about themselves, knowing me, then learn about each other, knowing you, and then together create some kind of social action project. So I sort of coined it knowing me, knowing you, there's nothing we can't do. the project was called Peace by Peace, which was P-E-A-C-E by P-I-E-C-E. And there were a lot of kind of false starts along the way with partnerships that didn't work or that had the wrong way of starting. Ultimately, we partnered with another Muslim supplementary school. We also had to figure out in that process where the GCSEs would fit in, because our kids were studying for a GCSE in Judaism and their kids were studying for a GCSE in Islam. And we kind of wanted to get rid of the GCSE anyway, because it's not that interesting and they have lots of other opportunities to do that kind of thing, but the parents wanted them doing it. And the project we began, I think about 8-9 years ago, and I left there 6 years ago, and the project's still running, which I think is kind of the biggest testament to it. Those kids form friendships that we hope will continue to last them. And I think the other piece that was mentioned in the prize was Jewish Christian theology writing that I've been quite a big part of, working in dialogue to create theological response to one another. But we can talk about that more if people are interested.
Yeah, of course. And Bilal, you particularly mentioned to me the work that British Muslim Television does in the interfaith space.
Yeah, so British Muslim TV, I mean, I'll talk a little bit about my own interfaith journey, I suppose, as well. I was very active as a Muslim student on campus. I studied medicine, so medical students tend to be at university a very long time. And so I got involved with the Islamic Society on campus, and then we ended up doing a lot of events with the Christian Union. And I sort of naturally sort of fell into this interfaithy role on campus. And then I was invited to take part in a very unique opportunity to work as a Faiths Act Fellow contentiously with the ex-Prime Minister Tony Blair. And so I had this big wrestle in my heart. Do I do this amazing opportunity to travel around the world and get paid and do all sorts of interesting work with the United Nations on faith? But it's with Tony Blair. And eventually I did it. I took a break from med school and really got thrusted into this global interfaith world. And that was just over 10 years ago now. And ever since, I've been very involved in different interfaith conversations and organizations and events all around the world. And so naturally, I think as a Muslim, as I sort of matured into my role as a Muslim community leader, I've always brought interfaith stuff with me. And for the last 5 years, I've been a director at the community TV channel, British Muslim TV. We broadcast on Sky, and we're based out of Yorkshire, although we have a studio in London as well. And it was just a very natural conversation to say, how are we going to do interfaith? And the way we ended up doing interfaith was actually taking a program that George is very involved with, Scriptural Reasoning. I think it's happening tomorrow.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And we made a TV show out of it. So we had a Muslim, Christian and a Jew sit around a table and do sort of a three-way scriptural reading. And it's very interesting, as someone who's a committed Muslim, I've always been taught that the Old Testament and the New Testament are just part of my tradition, and we should read them as if there are texts. And if we find something we don't quite agree with, we can just leave it. But the majority of it, sort of, it was almost a homecoming. And I really felt that came out in the show, where it was sort of, you know, the very spirit of scriptural reasoning is sharing and learning with each other. And it made a great show. And I produced 2 seasons of it. And I think there's some episodes up on YouTube, possibly.
Can we have a show of hands for anyone who's watched British Muslim Television?
Ooh. Yay, like 3
one or two. Well done. Yeah.
I have a show called Being Bilal, which is like a reality show about me.
Yeah, it's all about Bilal.
Yeah.
If you want a selfie with me later, we can do that.
I was going to ask the Alim.
Yeah, and Rabbi Debbie's been on me on out. So yeah, actually another interfaith element, one of our most watched shows is called Ask the Alim, which means basically ask the priest, ask the leader. And it's a show where you have an Islamic scholar and a presenter, and they sort of field different questions, anything and everything from, you know, is it permissible to eat caterpillars to, you know, how do I deal with my divorce? And 1/5 of our shows are actually interfaith shows. So we bring either a rabbi or a priest to sit in and have, again, like, this is the Muslim perspective, this is the Christian perspective, or this is the Muslim perspective, this is the Jewish perspective. And we also have an intra-faith version of the show where we bring Sunni and Shia scholars to answer the same question as well. So
great. Okay, thanks very much. Can we think a bit about the joys and the challenges? Maybe we start with the joys, because that might be easier to talk about. What's the interfaith encounter given you, that's given you pleasure and made you see things in a positive, happy way? Debbie?
So, I mean, I it sounds too big to be real, but actually I truly believe that interfaith dialogue made me the Jew that I am. I grew up in a family where I thought you were required to have a vicar at your Passover Seder, or it wasn't kosher. You know, my friendship group at school was not a Jewish friendship group. It was always, you know, diverse. And when I think that the key moment for me actually was when I went to Lancaster University, which I majored in comparative religion. I was passionate about religion. I wasn't intending to be a rabbi at all. I thought I'd probably be an RE teacher or something, because I'm just fascinated by what makes us do these things as humans. And encountering people at university who had never met Jews before and who just had some really bizarre ideas, frankly, as well as some quite prejudiced ideas.
For example, what were the bizarre ideas?
Well, one chap in my first RE seminar said, "Oh, that's interesting. I've never met a Jew before. I feel really sorry for you." Because the only thing he knew about Jews was Auschwitz. That was literally all he knew about Jews. And actually, it's a kind of a common modern problem. Everyone knows how Jews died. Nobody knows how Jews live. And I think that's one of the joys for me in interfaith dialogue, is to explore how do Jews live? What are we as a living, growing, existing people who are not just an idea and not just a part of your history, but are here today doing this? So answering people's questions about Judaism helped me find my voice and my Judaism. Mm. A lot of people are threatened by interfaith because they think they're going to lose their identity. But I absolutely feel like the bedrock of my Jewish identity has been that interfaith encounter. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to bring it to our teenagers, because it makes them better citizens and it makes them better Jews. It makes their identity a positive one in relation to the other, not a negative. Mm. It's not that I fear you and therefore I stick to my own and I know who I am, but I know how to be confident in me and therefore hear your difference.
Sure.
And that's a real joy for me.
So, Georgia, has the interfaith encounter made you a better Christian, would you say?
Absolutely. I completely echo everything just said. And I think the joy for me, almost to be summed up in one word, would be curiosity. It's a very curious space, the interfaith space. And the fact that when you step out, and it's not stepping, kind of leaving your community behind, but to step into a place where you're willing to have questions asked of you, suddenly all these elements of who I was as a Christian, which I just hadn't thought twice about, suddenly you're being asked, well, why do you believe that? Why do you pray like that? And not only that, to see other people who are actually perhaps modeling an integrity of prayer and worship and scriptural living that I wasn't even seeing in my own community. So I would definitely say the interfaith journey has completely refined me as a Christian, made me more confident in my faith, made me so joyous about my faith, actually, and what a joy it is to be able to share that with others and not be afraid that, you know, listening to someone else doesn't threaten my own faith, you know, so that's a real joy.
But isn't the Christian tradition full of the idea that we should be converting people to Christianity?
Yes, Michael. Yes. and I think that was initially...
That's why you brought me here.
Yes.
So, you got it too.
I'm surrounded by you guys.
You're the converted.
This is the platform. That's why I'm here. Yeah, and I think that for me is actually the real excitement, that how, as an evangelical Christian, and actually the funny thing is the first time I turned up into an interfaith space, and it actually happened very accidentally. And they were, in effect, saying, you know, you're welcome to be here fully as you are, but you're not allowed to evangelize, which is a very funny thing to say to an evangelical Christian. Mm. And so I think part of the adventure of interfaith for me has been, what does it really look like to create a space where you can be fully you? And including being someone who's, you know, passionate about faith and wanting to share that, but just being able to operate in a space where everyone else is going to be there doing the same thing.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry to throw that curved ball.
That's great.
Bilal.
Yeah. I mean, speaking about a joy and a challenge in one, I guess just building on what's been shared. I think when I was on campus, I used to get involved in all these really rigorous debates and the Trinity, is it logical? Is it illogical? And all going, you know, at each other. And it tends not to go anywhere. And once I sort of matured past the need to prove that I'm right and other people are wrong, you sort of end up in a really interesting community. And I think one of the joys as a Muslim and as someone who has tried to understand and connect with God, to witness God in another, and to witness God in another tradition, in a way that is, I personally don't like, because I believe as a Muslim, I believe this is true. I'm convinced of it, and I believe in this idea of salvific exclusivity, right? And I'm comfortable with that. But when I see, and it's sort of, it's a joy, but it's also a challenge. It's like, what does it mean for me to witness the presence of God in someone else, of another tradition, of another faith? And it's really wonderful to see that and experience that. But it's also challenging for me on a theological level and a personal level as to, now what do I do with that?
David Ford, who's one of the academic gurus behind the interfaith movement particularly, talks about the interfaith encounter enabling you to go deeper into your own faith. And it is an extraordinary thing, the encounter with Muslim and Christian and Jewish friends particularly has enabled me to find a much deeper sense of my own understanding of my faith. And I haven't felt that challenge that I need to change, or indeed that I need to change them either. So
there's also been an interesting sort of, I also feel, especially when I'm working with Christians, and I didn't think I'd see this, is that many Christians, practicing Christians, almost feel like a minority in their amongst themselves, and because they're white and middle class or whatever, it's they're not seen as a minority group at all. But the way that they practice their faith, and I've experienced that they will feel challenged to talk about God comfortably and openly, and I feel there's so much that there's so many parallels with the Muslim experience as well as the Jewish experience, and you know, there's lots of things which we disagree on, and we can talk about that until we get, you know, till the cows come home. But there's also many things that we can just agree on. We're concerned about education. We're concerned about whatever it's conservative values and over-sexualization of society or whatever it might be. And I really feel that those are points where communities can work together on, especially if we manage to organize a bit better and sort of cooperate. I think we could get a lot more done.
Indeed. Yeah. So, what about the challenges then? Because it's a tough space to be in as well. What have you encountered that has, you know, really made you have to dig deep to overcome? I shall allow you to choose who speaks first.
I think speaking out of what you said, Bilal, that I think I would say that the interfaith space has and still is often a space where I can feel most alienated. And that's a peculiar thing as well. And so the challenge to me of the interfaith space, one is committing to it, even though often I struggle to find the space where I feel I can be fully myself, and fully expressive of my faith. But within that, the challenge being of how can we find really fruitful interfaith spaces where we're acknowledging that if people are going to be, instead of, I mean, I think hospitality is a key element of interfaith work. And often instead of learning how to be host and guest to one another in one another's homes, interfaith can become almost this new building, which people can kind of move into. And that's where the struggle of compromise, I think, for me comes from. And so I think, learning how to be in those spaces where I feel that sometimes they've strayed quite far from what is familiar of the community that I come from, but also to speak into those spaces to say, well, how can we be real about the fact that there are serious differences here? We live very differently. And actually, this is only really exciting, as far as I'm aware, and fruitful if we're able to really find those clashing points. But when those clashing points do come, they can be painful and difficult, and learning how to navigate that and hold that space in love when we're all bringing, you know, there are a lot of common ways that we can approach the big picture, but we all bring very different contexts.
Can you think of a clashing point to illustrate that?
I'm trying to think on a classic issue on our programs actually is around scriptural reasoning. So scriptural reasoning, which is where we all share different scriptures together. And we had someone last year on a program we're doing, it was with students from across the UK and across the Middle East. And one of the Christian participants said that she couldn't possibly go into a room where people were opening the Quran because that so compromised what she believed and who she was. And in response to her reacting like that, another participant ends up reacting to the fact that they have such a view, and just offense just happens. And immediately there's, you know, this initiation of the stereotyping. And I think a lot of that comes down to the fear of the other, but also underlying that is two people who took their faith incredibly seriously. And underlying that was a deep, deep passion that we could dig down to connect on. But that's just something that, that springs to mind.
Really good, yeah. Rabbi Debbie, can you chip in?
So I think as Jews going into dialogue, there is often a nervousness about the missionizing that we joke about, and this sense of, I think one of the challenges actually historically is Jews have felt like such a minority that they go into the dialogue and don't always listen. They just want to speak into the space and make sure that everyone knows what it is to be Jewish, because there's only 270,000 of us in the UK and nobody knows us really. And people are often very good at listening and are very receptive. And I think one of the challenges is actually making sure that there is a real dialogue on both sides and that everyone is there to listen. I've also experienced horrible responses from people in all communities that are racist and xenophobic. And I just one classic, which frankly is embarrassing, but hopefully no one will print it. You know, a member of a synagogue responding to me by saying, you know, we really must make sure that we're doing dialogue with the Sikh and the Hindu community. Yes, of course, we've got wonderful partners in the Sikh and the Hindu community, because together with the Sikh and the Hindu communities, our numbers, we might have a better chance against the Muslims. I mean, that's not why we do these things. And, you know, but there is real fear behind, there's an anxiety of fear behind that and what's going on. Often, you know, there is real fear about what we compromise by going into the dialogue. There are cross-communal issues about going into dialogue. And of course, the elephant that sits in the room, and we were talking about it as a group just outside before we came in, is how we have real conversations that are meaningful and where both sides are heard, where it's not a monologue about Israel and Palestine, because that's the area that things between all the faiths that are represented here actually start to get really tricky. And it's kind of fascinating for lots of people that it's an issue that speaks to so many people when actually quite often they don't really have a massive connection to that space, but it's present and there. And I think that's one of the deepest challenges today.
Okay, Blau?
Yeah, I mean, just coming off what Debbie said, there's obviously a lot of anti-Muslim sentiment, a lot of Islamophobia, and I'm always pleasantly surprised when people can come with their ignorances and just be like, I don't know, can you just explain? And they answer, and they might have a lot of really skewed misconceptions about Islam, but they approach the space. And so that's great. It's sad that we have to do that whole deconstruction. But at the same time, it's really positive that people want to learn and are willing to be challenged. So that's the first thing. I think the second thing is that the interfaith space has become and is increasingly politicized. You know, maybe 15 years ago, government talked about race relations a lot, and then it moved into this conversation about multiculturalism. And then there was that whole community cohesion piece, and then we had that blip called Big Society. Don't know what happened with that. And often now you will see the language of faith and interfaith being used by ministers, by civil service, and they talk about faith communities and interfaith and so on. And so I'm sometimes wary about who is in the space and what's the agenda. Mm-hmm. And I've always had these two models of interfaith work in my mind. There's the palette model, right? You know, when you have a color palette and you have all these wonderful paints, and then you think, when I was a kid, I'll mix it together and I'll get a rainbow, right? And then you mix it together and you just get this brown, sort of grey brown sludge. And you can't paint with that. But a lot of interfaith tends to just want to just mix this all together and say, oh, boom, here you are. Whereas the model that I hope we can aspire to is the fruit salad model, where like you're the pineapple and you're the grape and you're the orange, and each of you can have your own distinct taste and color and texture and your own claim to fame. Call yourself the best fruit in the bowl if you want, but you're working with other people to create something greater than anyone and everyone.
A big fruit salad.
A big fruit salad. So that's really the model we should aspire to, where you can authentically be yourself, but you're working in community with other people. And as someone who's really been in the interfaith game a long time, you know, I've seen it in lots of different iterations. And again, on the Israel-Palestine issue, it's become really sore because I have personally experienced a lot of, because I'm relatively outspoken. I'm not very outspoken. For many, many years, I never commented on Israel-Palestine because I just thought, I don't know anything about it. Those people, those Muslims are doing the Israel-Palestine thing. Let them do their thing. I'm doing the interfaith thing. That was my line. Literally, I would say that at events for years. And then I married a Palestinian. And now I have family in Palestine who live under occupation, who, you know, experience really, you know, all of the horrors that you can think about, right? And when I speak to that truth, I've been really disheartened to have experienced Jewish colleagues who have contacted organizers of events, organizers like Greenbelt, for example, not actual Greenbelt, but equivalents, and say, he shouldn't be on your panel because he's an anti-Semite. But these are people that I've been in their house, I've had Shabbat meals with them, and they wouldn't approach me personally, but they've gone round. And to experience that has been really shocking. I've had some colleagues from different faith backgrounds who have stood in solidarity with me, and others who have just told me, look, this is the deal and we can't afford to upset our funders or whoever. And so that's become a challenge. That's obviously not the case with all Jews. I've had some really fruitful conversations with Jewish friends on Israel-Palestine. But I think because the space is becoming politicized, it's just we've got to be careful that we don't end up in the brown-gray sludge, and that we're bold enough to serve a fruit salad.
Okay, thank you. I would like to introduce our special guests on the floor. This came back to when I invited all 21 laureates to come to Greenbelt, and not thinking that anyone would want to come. Then I discovered that actually they did want to come, and my panel was already full, and I was deeply embarrassed. But our gracious friends here agreed that there'd be special guests here, and I would give them a chance to share as well. So firstly, Heston, would you like to introduce yourself and why you were a laureate, and then perhaps just a short form version of the challenges and joys?
I'm Heston. I'm a vicar in West Leeds, and we're one of the most multicultural interfaith parishes in Leeds, which is a very multicultural city. And I'm that annoying. I get to have a daily dose of fruit salad, and I think that's why I was up for this award. I'm the annoying vicar who goes to Debbie's bar mitzvahs and makes them kosher. I get to do this day in and day out. I live a life of interfaith fun and shenanigans. And I guess the joy, there's so many joys, but right at the top of the list is I now have a whole bunch of really cool friends who see life, who see God, who see humanity differently to the way I do. And that both reminds me that God and life and humanity are bigger and more extraordinary than I could ever dream, but also kind of, I guess, helped me to see that you and you and you and all of you are precious gifts from God and not someone to be used for my evangelistic ends or something like that. You have something to share with me of God. And that makes every day an adventure. I think the challenge for me, so my perspective is as a parish priest, and so quite kind of local parochial, is on a smaller scale, not like on a national scale, like some of these guys do things, is getting people who aren't interfaith professionals interested and involved. And so if you are a Christian, if you feel like a minority, like Bilal was saying, that's not how we're perceived by our Muslim and our Jewish and our Sikh and our Hindu neighbors. They see us as like really established. So maybe this is me mainly as an Anglican. We have churches, we have, you know, we're everywhere. And so one of the challenges is to use that establishment and our sort of settledness to stand with real minorities, folks who actually are suffering anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, and to offer our space, offer ourselves, our attention in solidarity and in love. How about that?
Thank you very much. Thank you. Yeah. And Catherine.
Hello, I'm Catherine, and I'm the Campus Leadership Manager at the Council of Christians and Jews. So my role there was to set up a new university interfaith program where I get to work with students and empower them to do their own events. And I find it encouraging just how much young people are able to use interfaith to do. There can be a stereotype about it, that it's just people sitting in a room with people of different faiths and having a little chat. But actually, they're using it to make a real difference in their communities, thinking about how our shared values can encourage us to help refugees, how we can look at different problems we might all be facing, like bad theology around mental health, and then put on events where people come together and discuss how they've been able to navigate this at their communities. But I'd say the biggest challenge for me has been realizing how much privilege I have as a Christian that maybe I wasn't aware of until I started doing interfaith. And particularly working at the Council of Christians and Jews and realizing how anti-Semitism has its roots in Christian ideas. So just a very quick example. When I started the role at one university, there was a case a few months after I joined where two Christian students walked up to a student wearing a kippah, asked him if he was Jewish, asked if any of his family died in the Holocaust. He said yes, told them about some relatives who died. And they said, well, that was their punishment for killing Jesus.
Oh, my goodness.
And I was completely shocked by this, but I'm realizing how much anti-Semitism has its root in Christianity. And I think it's so important to use interfaith for Christians to look into their own beliefs and realizing that even some of the preaching we hear in our churches is used to put down Judaism to make Christianity look good. But if we have to make Judaism look bad to make Jesus look good, what does that say about our own faith?
Thank you very much. Yeah. And finally, welcome Ruth.
Hi, I'm Ruth.
Hi, Ruth.
How embarrassing. So I must say that most of my interfaith work was through a really lovely church in London called St. James's Piccadilly, and I can see a crowd of you here, so that's great. Mostly I did it by accident. So I was looking after a refugee drop-in on a Saturday morning, and it gradually turned into a deeper and deeper friendship with the regular people who came there, and we started talking about faith. And they asked me some questions that I had never thought about. So one of them came and said, okay, so communion, I'm not quite up with the eating Jesus thing, but if I were to bring my own Hovis, how would that be? And I had no idea, like none. So I had to refer that one to the vicar, and she said, yes, we'll take a picture for the website. And then I thought, maybe not. And then gradually we got to know this amazing Muslim group, which are a group of liberal Muslims called City Circle in London. And they were helping us with quite a lot of our night shelter, and I spent an evening remembering Srebrenica with them, and they were just so fun. Eventually I was like, how about you all just come for dinner and we'll call it like a peace feast or something, and we'll just have a great time. And it was wonderful. We had some amazing conversations, which really made me think about some of the preconceptions I have. And some of them I still haven't got answers to. Like, should we be using the Isaiah readings at Christmas? I think that is a question that I'm sitting with. What should we call the Old Testament? Is that an appropriate term? Does it imply supersessionalism, which does lead to anti-Semitism, which did lead to the Holocaust, which Christians, we did play a huge role in? How do we challenge those assumptions, and where do we go? And at the moment, I'm at Queen's. Debbie's one of the tutors, actually, so I hope I haven't said anything wrong.
Well, Debbie, has she said anything wrong?
No.
Would you like to respond, though, to that particular challenge, I think, of the supersessionism and how awkward that is for everybody?
So I'll tell you a Greenbelt story. I've only been to Greenbelt once before, and it was in 2003, and I was here working for the Council for Christians and Jews, where I was the youth dialogue facilitator, and I was 23. I had, you know, grown up not necessarily surrounded just by Jews, but certainly to put myself into a space where there were, it felt like 15,000 Christians at Cheltenham Racecourse, was quite a big, big deep breath. I did experience some very fascinating conversations. People thought that essentially the CCJ was the CMJ, which is the Christian mission to the Jews, who have a slightly different agenda to dialogue. I met a Jewish woman who wanted to tell me, she was working on the festival, she was telling me all about her experience working the lights, and she'd grown up in South America, she'd moved to Israel, she'd come to England for some work, and after 50 minutes of chatting, and I'd invited her to join me for a ceremony at the end of Shabbat, she said, "And when did you find Jesus?" Oh, I didn't. Whoops. Sorry. But the one of the strongest memories I have of that green belt, other than those very strange conversations at the stall, was I went to a session with an amazing Christian educator beside me from CCJ, Jane Clements, if any of you know her, who was kind of looking after me at green belt. And she decided we should go to a talk on Is Jesus the Way, the Truth, and the Light? And it was a fascinating conversation, mostly, I think, with different clergy on the panel. And one of them, I think, said something like, you know, everyone can get to heaven through Jesus, but you'll just meet Jesus after death. You know, it's not, you don't have to find Jesus in this life, which was a relief. And Jane tells it better than I do, because I don't actually remember doing this so much. But apparently I stood up and made a little contribution, essentially saying, I don't really care if you think I'm going to hell. I had been told by people at Lancaster I was going to hell as well. I'm not that worried if you think I'm going to hell. We don't believe in hell anyway. I care how you treat me now in this life, in this world, which we do have power over. There was a bigger conversation about end times yesterday. You know, I don't know what the end looks like. And my Judaism teaches me not to worry about it. My Judaism teaches me to make the most of this life and the here and now, and to make this world as good as I can, to leave it better than I found it. There is an incredibly painful history between all of our communities. And there is also incredible light and joy in all of our traditions that we can share. I'm not interested in us all trying to, you know, make anyone feel bad about history that they didn't play a part in. I'm not interested in us trying to blame each other for anything that's going on in the world right now that we don't have power over. I'm also not interested in us all trying to say we're the same, really, because we're not. And I love that we're not the same. Yeah. I don't want us to be the same. I want us to be really comfortable with each other's differences and to see that it is our diversity that is made in God's image. God's image is diverse. I cannot comprehend of God, because God is so enormous. It is our diversity that reflects God's enormousness.
Well said. I'm just going to ask Bilal if you want to say anything before we open to the floor, that from what's been said by our special guests and what Debbie was just saying.
Not really. Just I suppose. I mean, given that there are laureates all around us, you know, for the 21 for 21 award, and just how incredible it is that these young people are really going beyond their comfort zones at a young age, asking deep questions of themselves. Yeah, yeah. And so I just wanted to thank them for coming and sharing. So,
yeah, indeed. Absolutely. Okay. We have a roving microphone operated by Roving Kenny, as he's known. And if you do want to put your hand up and make yourself available, Kenny, look behind you. Oh no, indeed, by the go for the pole here first. When I say pole, I mean the person by the pole. Sorry.
But I thought he's from South Africa.
You might be Polish, but we don't know.
Thank you for such an interesting panel. Sometimes I hear a sort of perverse reading of coexistence and interfaith, known as like the Judeo-Christian culture or civilization, which is often invoked by far-right commentators. And I was wondering, Islam, of course, being conspicuously absent, I was wondering if you could sort of speak to that and how we talk about, yeah, true interfaith work.
I'm going to let you choose who answers that, since it wasn't directed. Remember, we've got Debbie, Bilal, and Georgia, so do use their names if you want to target a particular person. Are you happy for any of them to have a go? Okay.
Well, I mean, so there's this website called notjordanpeterson.com. And basically, it's really interesting. You can type in anything, and because he's talked so much, it's an artificial intelligence which regenerates. So whatever you type, he will say, and it says it really brilliantly. And so there was a clip going around on the Muslim WhatsApp, you know, network groups, all these groups of where all the Muslims organize. And it was Jordan Peterson saying, obviously not him saying, but a spoof of him saying, if we want to return to the Judeo-Christian values that we hold so dear, we should return to Islam. And I really feel that when Judeo-Christian values are cited, I mean, it's so ironic that Jesus is a Palestinian. He's olive-skinned. He's dark, you know, dark hair, curly hair. He looks like my father-in-law more than he's going to look like anyone else who's here, right?
And he's Jewish.
And he's Jewish, right, exactly. Kept kosher and all that. So never ate pork, et cetera, et cetera. So I think when we hear those terms, I really feel that they've been claimed and they need to be reclaimed. They need to be reclaimed as you said, they're hijacked by the far right. And it doesn't, this doesn't represent, you know, Europe isn't Judeo-Christian. Spain, Muslims were in Spain for 900 years. They ruled Spain for 600 years. That's in Spain, you know. Bosnia, Malta, Turkey, there's all these parts of the Ottoman Empire in Europe. And so much of Judeo-Christian culture, the Renaissance, it lends and it built and it married with Muslim civilization and Muslim culture. So I suppose the people who are talking about Judeo-Christian values, they're really hijacking the term and they're really belying history. They're just, it's just, it's a lie. Yeah.
Okay, there were some definite questions over there. Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if you wanted to add anything.
Yeah. Do chip in.
I mean, I would only like chip in that Judaism is so diverse, the idea that there is one Judeo-Christian culture is laughable, right? There, you can't name which what's yeah. Jewish culture. It's so diverse.
Yeah.
And we all disagree with each other.
Okay.
Yeah. I do work in interfaith training in Southall in London, so I'm very aware of a lot of the issues that you're talking about. One of the issues I'm aware of is that people can quite often come and they're anxious about encountering different faiths. And at the end, they're very open to dialogue and engagement with faiths. But I'm also aware that they're going back to communities where their message will definitely not be welcome. And I'm just wondering if you have any ideas how you can prepare people for going back to their communities.
I think that's one of the challenges that we're actually mostly concerned about, especially when we run programs. So, and particularly this summer actually was our first time of doing a program with 14 to 17 year olds, and so they're experiencing coming away from their families and having this intense experience where they're going on this journey of never having experienced interfaith community before, finding wonderful friendships with people from other faiths, and then being sent back not only into communities that aren't on the same page as that, but actually family contexts, which will challenge that. So for us in the programs that we do, it's been, and I'm mainly learning from experience and part of the challenge of that, we now have a much longer process of thinking, how can we firstly come alongside families and communities? And almost the program that we run is a very small part of the journey. So for this program that we just did, it started with leaders within communities, working with them, then meeting parents, working with them, then having the experience of the actual residential with the children. And then the next step is to go back, return to the parents, and then continue to work with the community. So I think it's easy to take the easy route with interfaith sometimes, and actually to take seriously the challenges and to take seriously the identity transformation that can happen as people start realizing the gift of encountering those of other faiths. But that's an incredibly sensitive issue that can actually cause further division on their return home. So how can we take that seriously? And often it's just taking the much longer, harder path to get there. And I think going slowly.
So chip in, anyone? Bilal? Debbie? Okay, is there another question? Yep. There's quite a few. Oh, gosh, yes.
Yes, just carrying on from that. I just wonder how each of you would say to what extent you can be representative of your religion. Ooh. And to what extent also are you having to deal with a conservative backlash within your religion who see you as selling out or being liberal?
Debbie, perhaps you'd like to...
Yes, a brilliant question. I always go into interfaith work with the premise that we can only ever really speak from the eye. And I think it's really important that when we do this work, we do only speak from the eye. An example of why, when I was involved in this book I mentioned, called, it's called Deep Calls to Deep. We were Jews and Christians writing in partnership for about 3 years. My area of writing was on absolutism, religious absolutism. So this is the truth. End of. And I was writing with someone called Reverend Alan Race, who some of you may have come across. He's quite famous for writing in this area. Now, what I did was write, but essentially a personal theology. This is how my Judaism teaches me that I don't hold the ultimate truth, that I cannot know the ultimate truth, and therefore there is something to learn from all of you. Alan wrote a fabulous piece, basically saying more or less the same things, but from a very academic, Western, well-researched approach. Brilliant article. When the group responded to us, and David Ford was part of this group as well, oh, Debbie, that was so lovely. Alan, you're just wrong. And there's a way that we respond to one another. When something is argued from the head and the theological, maybe, which is an important thing to do. We mustn't dismiss that part of the work. But actually, when you speak from the eye, it's very difficult to attack that. So I don't, I work at the head offices of Reformed Judaism. I very often represent Reformed Judaism. But actually, when we go into interfaith work, and when we go out into the world generally, I don't think we can ever represent anything bigger than ourselves. And understanding that in our encounters with each other is really powerful. You get backlash for all sorts of things. I actually ironically find that interfaith work is one of those places where cross-Jewish communal work can happen more easily, because Orthodox rabbis are often not allowed to share a platform with Reform rabbis, although, as you may see later in the programme, my husband is one. But they can come to an interfaith space and it's not a problem, right? Because we're talking in a bigger conversation, so I can have the Reform person there.
Okay.
I'm interested in a Muslim perspective on this sort of...
Yeah, I think it's about, you know... Sure. Yeah, so the first point, I think it depends on your intention, you know. There was an event we used to do on campus called Mutual Misunderstandings, and it was just, you know, explaining what is a Muslim perspective on XYZ issue. And I think it's important to know what is it you're getting into. Is it a case of, okay, so I'm explaining to you this is what generally Muslims believe about XYZ, as opposed to my personal journey, which has its place. So I think it's just making sure you're able to be multi-contextual. As for the backlash, you know, I feel as a Muslim, me doing interfaith work is an expression of Orthodox Islam, and I can draw from and I'm an Orthodox traditional Muslim, as traditional as you can get, but that calls me to be engaged with other people of other faith. And I can look at the Prophet's life, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be blessings upon him, his life, as and look at the interfaith encounters that he had with Christians and Jews specifically, as well as other traditions. So when people try and people have tried and say, oh, this interfaith stuff is just watering down Islam, blah, 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 I can challenge them right back and say, well, actually, what was the Prophet doing here? Well, the first person to affirm prophecy, when the Prophet Muhammad, when the angel Gabriel, as we believe, gave revelation to the Prophet Muhammad, the first person who affirmed him was his Christian brother-in-law, who was a Christian monk, and said, well, there's something holy going on over here. So we have it right at the core of our tradition. We have interfaith encounter. And anyone who says otherwise, is, as far as I'm understanding, doesn't understand Islam.
Okay, thank you. We've got time for a couple more. Oh, we've got three.
Should
we got
take
too
a
many.
Round?
Should we take... Well, we're taking three at once. Can go badly wrong, I've discovered.
Up to you, sorry.
Shall we go over here? Yeah. Sorry, we'll try to get... We've got another 8 minutes, 7 minutes.
I was just going
three
to say...
We've got 3 minutes. Three people. Sorry. Go on then, yeah.
Sorry, yes. I was just going to say that my personal take on it is that God is so ununderstandable that we cannot possibly claim to have all the answers, and that each different major faith has a great deal to contribute to the others, and the others have a great deal to gain from the mix. And I love your example of the fruit salad, because all the different flavours enhance each other and make the whole thing greater than any one of them. And on that basis, I think anybody who claims to have all the answers, run from them.
Okay. Just hold that in your thoughts to respond to. Can we have two more quick ones, relatively short questions, please?
Hi, thank you so much. I was just wondering, like, if as a result of dialogue between faith, the way you relate to God has changed, and if so, how?
Yeah, so one of you take that one. And one more?
Yeah, unless I misquote her. Karen Armstrong and the Golden Rule. Does the panel think that that's a founder, you know, a cornerstone for interfaith work, or is it reductive?
Okay. Do you want to pick up on those thoughts, the comment and the questions?
I love that question about how has interfaith changed the way you relate to God. And I think it actually relates very much to the first comment of, I think, seeing and understanding how vast God is and how little I know in comparison to God, and just seeing creation in a whole new way and the diversity that people have been made in the image of God. And there's just something very significant that changes the moment you look at the other and seek God in their face. I think suddenly an intimacy of relationship with God is opened up that for me wasn't there before. So I think that would be the primary change, that now my relationship with God is so much more about how much further can I challenge myself to really seek God in the most unlikely places.
Yeah. One, Debbie? Blau?
Sure. I when I went to university, I actually majored in Hinduism for a lot of it. And I loved this image that Ramakrishna had of all faiths are paths up the mountain, taking different routes to the same goal. And I really was sad that that wasn't my idea from Judaism. But actually, being involved in interfaith allowed me to read my tradition and find those texts that do give me that message. My own way of doing it is Exodus 33, when God says, no one can see all of me and manage, right? Your head will explode, whatever. We can't all know. And this is at the core of Torah. This is the revelation. This is the moment that Moses is getting the second tablets. It's an important time to be told, you don't have all the truth. Don't think that you've got all the truth. So I loved, through conversation with dialogue, being able to find the bits that I wanted in my faith.
Yeah, there's a poem in Arabic, which I won't recite to you, but one of the lines, he says, the inability to perceive God is perception of God. And just speaking to the last bit about the golden rule, that, you know, I think at the same time, we have to realize that people are starting from very different places. And when you meet someone, the first thing, you know, I met Heston earlier, and he's like, I'm a priest in Leeds. And I'm like, oh, I live in Leeds. Like, you look for the common connection, right? And then from that connection, you can build. So, you know, interfaith discussions can get incredibly political, incredibly theological, incredibly deep. But I think, you know, they happen all the time. Well, if you, and perhaps this is a good note to sort of end on, really, is that, you know, everyone, and I feel, especially people here, and hopefully everyone in this room, do you call this a room? In this tent, you know, you can be an ambassador of multi-faith engagement and interfaith, and it's just about finding the common denominator. And if you start at that golden rule, it's a great starting point. That, okay, we're from Leeds, or we have this same connection. You believe that, and I believe that too. And from there, we can take it somewhere. And I just think more and more people need to be more courageous, more curious, as Georgia said, to sort of step out of your comfort zones, meet another person, meet another community, and then it can take you on an amazing journey.
Okay, I'm going to actually draw a close to this now, because people need to get to their next thing. I think we've had our hour. I would like to thank, obviously, Georgia and Heston and Catherine and Ruth for being here, but acknowledging that coming to Greenbelt for us is a wonderful thing. We'd probably be here anyway, and how lovely is that? But thank you all very much. But particular thank to Debbie and Bilal, who have gone out of their comfort zone to come to Greenbelt, and I really hope you have felt the Greenbelt welcome. I really do, but thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. At Greenbelt, we make a space where artistry meets activism, where the political meets the practical, where the sacred meets the secular. We think we're somewhere to dream up a better world, to dance and debate, to pray and to party. Visit greenbelt.org.uk to browse and download other great thinking from our recorded catalogue. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.